This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You've got the dollar, the euro, and the Japanese yen, the big three of the global currency markets, if you will. Generally speaking, the bigger the economy, the more relevant the currency. So the news over the weekend that China is going to let the yuan float against the dollar is a big deal indeed. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 21st of June today. Beijing picked this past Saturday to announce a change in policy that Washington and much of the rest of the financial world have been waiting for some time now, that they are going to take the Chinese currency, the yuan, off its peg to the dollar and let it float, that is, trade freely. Our China correspondent Scott Tong is on the line with us from Shanghai. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Kai.
Why now on this currency decision?
Well, in China, there is a little bit of fear of inflation. And China imports a whole lot of things from around the world, soybeans from the United States and minerals from Australia, oil, obviously, from the Middle East. And with a weak currency, imports are expensive. So one reason for this is to get at some of the inflationary pressures in China. Obviously, there is a whole lot of external pressure coming from the U.S. Congress, and there is a G20 meeting coming up at the end of the week. And China obviously knows that this is coming. More pressure will be around the corner. So most people think is a good time to do it.
Likely effects then in the short term, both within China and then in the global economy. What do you think?
China is telling the world that, okay, we're going to boost our currency. We're going to hurt our exporters a little bit because, you know what, we can take it. The economy is strong enough. And so China saying out loud that their economy is strong enough is a great signal for people who want to take some more risk. As far as the currency actually appreciating, most of the economists and bankers out this way think it's just going to creep up. So even in 12 months from now, we may see a 4% appreciation in the Chinese currency against the dollar. So there, don't hold your breath.
Let's say you're an American manufacturer selling whatever it is. You want to get into the Chinese market for exports. What's this decision going to mean for you?
I think it depends if you're selling into the China market, because if you're selling to Chinese consumers, it's good. What happens with a stronger currency is it makes exports more expensive, but it makes imports less expensive. So the Chinese consumer has a lot more buying power to buy General Motors vehicles, to buy iPhones, whatever. And that's what the world wants. They want more balancing of the global economy and China to start buying more things, consuming more and saving less.
Mm-hmm. Big day for you on the broadcast today, Scott. You're going to be back later on with the beginning of a week-long special series on China's one-child policy. Tell us what you got for us.
Well, the one-child policy is in its 30th year. The idea was China 30 years ago was not wealthy enough per person. One way to get at that was fewer persons. So it was mandatory that for the vast majority of people in China, they could only have one child. And so here's the tease. Part one of the one-child policy series, its economic history, airs later in the show.
Scott Tong in Shanghai. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Kai.
Scott's one-child piece is coming up in just a bit, but there is at least one more thing to say about this currency story. The White House said today the decision was encouraging, which last time I checked is bureaucraties for, yeah, we're going to see how it goes. Policymakers here in the U.S. and Congress specifically have been pushing the Chinese to let the U.N. appreciate for years now. They say that is the quickest way to right the serious U.S. trade deficit with China. But Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports ordinary Chinese might get more out of the decision than Americans will.
There's no doubt about it, says Boris Schlossberg, the director of currency research at GFT. He says a stronger yuan will mean more on the streets of Beijing than it does in Baltimore.
Even a small appreciation of the yuan gives the average Chinese worker more value for his money. So clearly, from that point of view, I think the Chinese worker does win.
Schlossberg says as long as that Chinese worker uses his money to buy imported goods, he'll get more bang for his buck.
Even if the yuan appreciates by 5% by the year end, that means his salary will be able to buy 5% more goods.
But the dollar's been getting more valuable compared to other key currencies over the last couple of years, and I don't feel any richer. Mark Chandler, the head of currency strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman, says that's because it's not all about the currency. By the time an imported product makes it to the shelf of the local supermarket, he says, the price has been impacted by the cost of shipping, storage, and marketing.
And each gets their own markup. So by the time we're done, the finished good that we buy at a store as consumers might be as much as 50% higher.
And therefore, any small fluctuation in the currency is a drop in the bucket. Chandler says we feel currency swings the most when we're traveling overseas and we change our dollars into local money. But, he says,
most Americans don't travel overseas. We tend to do our vacations here within the States. When we do go overseas, among the things we are looking at very often is not the currency and how cheap it is.
So what about the idea that having a weaker currency is better for jobs, that cheaper goods will bring in more business and lead to more domestic hires? Economist David Backus at NYU's Stern School of Business says that's a nice theory, but it's hard to prove.
There are lots of factors going on. This is one of them, but it's not the only one, and it's very hard to detect an effect from that on its own.
Backus says China's currency move will have a much bigger impact on global politics than it will on you and me. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Traders were all excited about that currency news early on today, and then they got over it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So you're out there randomly cruising the internet. Most of the sites you visit are plastered with ads, of course. And those ads don't make it there by accident, you know. Companies have a lot of information that they have gathered about you, and they use that info to tailor ads specifically for you. Targeting, it's called. There is a lot about that process that regulators find objectionable. So advertisers are trying to head them off at the pass. They are introducing a way to opt out of those targeted ads. Michael Learmonth writes about something that's being called the Power Eye, a little icon on some of those ads. He writes in Ad Age today. Michael, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
This Power Eye thing sounds a little bit ominous. What is it and what does it do?
It's an attempt to sort of put some transparency in online display advertising. So ads you see on the web will allow you to see why you got those ads.
In other words, what they know about you that made you an attractive target.
That's right.
So how does it actually work? I mean, what's going to happen when you click on that Power Eye thing?
You'll get a list of sources of data that was used to target that ad. So you'll probably see two or three companies that collect data, and they'll give you some idea of what that data is. You know, have you researched travel lately? You'll see that kind of information.
And then I will have a choice to opt out, right?
Yes. You can say no. You can say, I don't want that kind of targeting. I don't want these kinds of ads to know this information about me.
But that's not opting out of advertising entirely, right? I'm just going to see a different kind of ad.
No, you can't opt out of advertising in general on the web. I mean, as much as you might like you could opt out of all the targeting within one ad. That doesn't opt out of the ad. Instead of an ad for, say, like an iPhone, which might be targeted at a high-income individual, you'd get a more generic AT&T ad. Many, many big marketers are trying it out, including Microsoft, American Express, Adidas. You're going to see these ads across the web very soon.
What is it that they try to get about us and then use and turn around?
Behind online advertising is data. And this is the, you know, the most sought-after resource in advertising today. And a growing percentage of online display ads have a lot of data on you and use that data to, you know, more effectively reach the people they want to reach.
When you say they have data on you, do you mean like me, Kai Rizdahl, or do you mean me, this, you know, 40-something white guy who makes XXX amount of dollars a year?
The latter, 40-something white guy.
Okay.
The personally identifiable information is where they draw the line.
Uh-huh.
And that's something they, you know, all pledge not to collect or use.
Now, it seems to me that they have this information. It's valuable to them. They're going to a lot of trouble to disclose what they know. Why are they doing that?
Well, they kind of have to. There is a bill that will be introduced in Congress later this year that would regulate online advertising. The FTC has told the online ad business that they really have one chance to kind of get it right, that they need to figure out a way to disclose what information is being used to target advertising to consumers. And if they don't do that, then, you know, regulation is going to be the next step.
Is it going to cost these companies any money, though, any potential lost revenue because they won't be able to advertise as effectively?
Well, what they hope is this system works and that it satisfies regulators. And if it does, it really doesn't cost them anything. They can kind of go about doing what they're doing. This system will cost, you know, a small amount of money, maybe a penny per thousand impressions, right? Marginal cost. But if there is regulation, it's hard to know what that would cost the industry. Obviously, it would affect everyone equally, but it would definitely make online display advertising kind of less appealing to marketers. They might move money into search, which is, you know, totally unregulated. So, you know, marketers seeking that kind of targeting would probably go to other types of media.
Michael Learmonth, he's a digital editor at Ad Age magazine. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It is Power I, by the way, as in the letter I, not the I you see with. But if you want to see what it looks like, and you got to look real close because it's a tiny little thing, we've got more online. Our website is marketplace.org. The law school class of 2010 has just graduated, and like their fellow graduates at virtually every level of education, they are pouring into a job market that's still flush with members of the class of 2009. It's even worse for members of the legal profession, though. Last spring, a lot of high-profile law firms put their first-year associates into recession-related holding patterns, paying them somewhat less than a full salary to wait around for a year until there was more work. Now, after they're cooling their heels for 12 months, those deferred lawyers are finally headed to their desks, which means more lawyers than anybody knows what to do with. Ashley Meltite reports.
Yelena Schreiberg had planned to start slaving away at a large Manhattan law firm in the fall of 2009. But during her finals at Brooklyn Law School last spring, she got some bad news. Her firm wouldn't be taking on all its new hires. Some would start on time, some would start in the spring of this year.
And the third group to which I was placed into was going to start in the fall in October 2010.
Until then, the firm said it would pay Schreiberg about half her salary, around $70,000, if she took a job with a nonprofit. She's now working as in-house counsel at a hospital network. She's enjoying the work, but she's itching to start her real job.
It's better to know that you're there and you're committed and you are striving for that promotion to make relationships that will last for years and years.
Firms are mostly making good on their promises to take back deferred graduates. Sometimes they're recalling people earlier than planned. But the backlog of lawyers is bad news for the class of 2010. Camille Chinkey-Fatt is career services director at Brooklyn Law School. She says the big firms have cut hiring by 25% this year. And they're shrinking their summer work programs too. Traditionally a pipeline of future lawyers. Take global firm Skadden Arps.
When I say to folks that Skadden Arps in New York has hired about 30 summer associates this year, their mouths drop because normally it would be about 100 more than that.
I think we've got at least the class of 2009 and probably the class of 2010 that are becoming somewhat of a lost generation in terms of new lawyers.
Ward Bauer is with legal management consultancy Altman Weil. He says many students were banking on big law jobs to pay off their six-figure loans. And recent graduates aren't just competing against each other. They're up against a glut of lawyers laid off last year. Bauer says the recession has made companies rethink what they're willing to pay for legal services.
There's just so much emphasis on managing, controlling, and reducing legal costs that they will find other ways to get things done, or they won't do them at all.
That could mean less demand for lawyers for at least the next few years. 2009 Brooklyn Law School graduate Previn Warren feels like one of the lucky ones.
I mean, to be quite frank, the work that I'm doing right now is incredibly stimulating.
Warren's start date at his Midtown firm was pushed back to January 2011. In the meantime, he's been clerking for a federal judge.
The tasks with which I'm charged are, more exciting and challenging than the tasks with which I'll be charged as I come into a large law firm as a first-year associate.
That said, he is looking forward to finally starting his career as a highly paid labor lawyer. He's already bought the home to go with the job. Soon it'll be easier to pay for it. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Coming up, population and economics in China.
It was not really a population issue, but the growing population, you know, actually made those problems more apparent. I think that drove the leadership to have a more forceful birth control program.
But first, let's do the numbers. Competing with China could be easier thanks to Beijing's currency adjusting moves, but investors figured out that Chinese goods are going to cost us more. So the Dow dipped 8 points, not quite a tenth of 1%, finished at 10,442. The NASDAQ slipped 20 points, nearly 1%, ended at 2289. The S&P 500 trimmed 4 points, about a third of 1%, wrapped up at 1,113. Concerns over higher-cost Chinese imports hit the world's biggest retailer. Walmart stock lost 1%. Rival Target missed the mark by almost 1.5%. You think of how many Chinese-made components go into an iPod or an iPhone, and you'll understand why Apple shares peeled off nearly 1.5% of their values today. Other tech stocks suffered similar fates. Hewlett-Packard pulled back nearly 1%. Motorola down 1.25%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Senate Armed Services Committee holds a hearing on military suicides. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales at existing homes for the month of May. And every night, 640,000 people in the United States are without a home. The nation's first comprehensive strategy to end homelessness is unveiled at the White House. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Two items by way of introduction to our next story. First of all, one of the co-chairmen of the presidential commission that's investigating the Gulf oil spill said today that the six-month moratorium on deepwater drilling is probably going to stay in place for a while. Big oil and its supporters say the industry is losing money every single day that it can't drill. Also today, the Environmental Protection Agency said it supports a bill that would reinstate taxes on the oil and gas industry to pay for the Superfund program. That's the pot of industry money that was set up 30 years ago to clean up the worst of all the hazardous waste sites that are out there. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports that pot needs some topping off.
It may have seemed like a great name when it was established in 1980, but the term superfund doesn't really describe it anymore.
What happened is that the superfund dwindled.
That's Earl Blumenauer, Democratic congressman from Oregon. He says that when Republicans took control of Congress in 1995, they did away with a tax on the petrochemical industry that funded the cleanup of almost half of all Superfund sites. These were sites where nobody accepted responsibility for the contamination. Funding for these projects dried up 7 years ago. Since then, taxpayers have had to pick up the tab. Congressman Blumenauer has authored a bill that would reinstate the tax.
For years, the industry has benefited from being able to have wide application of petroleum and chemical products. Part of the cost of doing business ought to be making sure that they are disposed of in a responsible fashion.
The National Petrochemical and Refiners Association isn't thrilled. Charles Drevna is the group's president.
Does the administration want a strong and vibrant domestic petrochemical and refining industry, or do they want to outsource those products to foreign governments and foreign producers at the cost of hundreds of thousands of direct jobs and, if not, millions of indirect jobs?
Almost a quarter of all Americans live within 4 miles of a Superfund site. Lori Fisher heads a citizens group affected by contamination from a coal gasification plant in Burlington, Vermont.
I don't know if we can just isolate one industry and maybe the tax has to be broader, but I think that it shouldn't solely be shouldered by citizens.
Especially, says Fisher, citizens who worry that they've already paid for these sites with their health. I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The macroeconomic talk today, as we heard from Scott Tong earlier, was all about China and its currency, Beijing deciding to let the yuan float against the dollar. That decision has both global and domestic implications for the Chinese economy. But another policy has had far more profound effects. China's one-child policy will have been around for 30 years come this September. Hundreds of millions of Chinese are forbidden by law from having more than one child. This week, our China correspondent Scott Tong is going to examine the social and economic effects of that policy, starting today with the history of how it came to be.
When the Communist Party took control of China in 1949, it inherited the most populous country on Earth, with 500 million people, triple the population of the U.S. Party Chairman Mao Zedong proclaimed having lots of people was a very good thing. It meant more workers, more soldiers for the People's Republic. It was a matter of national pride, says anthropologist Susan Greenhall at the University of California, Irvine.
The U.S. Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, he thought that the communist regime would not be able to feed the population.
An angry Mao, she says, fired back at the naysayer.
And Mao said, of all things in the world, people are the most precious.
But China could not feed all its people. From 1958 to 1961, 30 million starved to death from famine. Chen Meifeng remembers that time well. She's the aunt of our marketplace assistant in China, Cecilia Chen.
In our village, we ate tree leaves and branches. We'd soak the leaves in a paste made from limestone powder and then cook them.
My own aunt, Luo Jiana, grew up in the 60s and remembers hardly ever eating meat.
My family had 4 kids and a grandmother, so 7 in all. My neighbor's family had just 2 kids. It seemed they always lived better, had newer clothes, and tastier food.
Shortages came largely from botched state planning, says demographer Wang Feng at the University of California, Irvine. But the convenient scapegoat was too many people.
It was not really a population issue, but the growing population actually made those problems more apparent. I think that drove the leadership to have a more forceful birth control program.
Chairman Mao had changed his stance by the 70s, as China's population passed 800 million. He now spoke of controlling growth. The government started asking people to volunteer to have fewer babies. Che Yuelian was an early messenger, a member of a virtual army of family planning enforcers in the countryside.
The campaign was hard at the start. Villagers teased me, but I wasn't ashamed. One year I convinced 7 women to get IUDs, 6 to have abortions.
Efficient enforcers won hard cash bonuses. Parents who complied got benefits too, including the mother of Cecilia Chen at Marketplace. Cecilia says after she was born in 79, her mom wrote up a pledge at work,
saying, I promise this is the only kid I'm going to have. She got 100 days vacation instead of 56.
The soft sell seemed to work. During the 1970s, China's fertility rate plunged from about 6 births per woman to less than 3. Still, the voluntary program was about to go mandatory. Mao had died. The new leader, Deng Xiaoping, inherited a China in the poorhouse. And demographer Wang Feng says Deng's regime was determined to change that.
They realized that political legitimacy rests on how they could deliver a rapid increase in standard of living, and that has to be measured on a per capita basis. So population became the denominator for everything.
Deng Xiaoping set economic targets measured by income per person. One way to get there was fewer persons. So on September 25th, 1980, the one-child policy ceased to be voluntary. Parents who didn't comply could lose their jobs. They faced hefty fines and penalties. In the early years, enforcers carried out tens of millions of sterilizations and abortions, despite resistance in the countryside. There are exceptions to the one-child policy. Some ethnic minorities can have 3 kids. Most farmers are allowed 2, as are families where both parents are themselves only children. And 30 years later, the reality is inescapable. There are fewer children around. China's fertility rate is an estimated 1.6 births per woman, one of the lowest rates in the world. Now, was it the policy or just urbanization? Folks who move to cities tend to have fewer children anyway. Either way, demographer Wang Feng argues the economic goals that drove the policy have been achieved. It's time to move on.
The official document anticipated the policy will be phased out in 20, 30 years, which is now.
He warns the policy deprives China of young people to work and pay taxes, care for the elderly, and invent things. The party line, though, is clear that the one-child policy has prevented 400 million births and, for purposes of economic growth, will remain in place. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Our staff researcher Cecilia Chen contributed to Scott's report. The series continues here all week and tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report with the pressures that face an entire generation of only children. You could trace the history of China's one-child policy, complete with interactive timeline, pictures, audio, the whole deal. It's on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today brought to you because Congress starts working on its financial reform package again tomorrow. There's a new Associated Press poll out today about the cause of the crisis and the new rules that are being suggested. 80% of people blame the banks for the crisis. 70% blame the government. Fine, no surprise. 64% say they think the new regulations Congress is debating won't do anything to prevent another crisis. Thing is, we're not going to prevent another crisis. There is going to be another financial meltdown someday. All the academics tell you that. The only question they have is how bad it's going to be and how or whether those rules are going to change that. So as Congress debates, we got to go. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow down 8 points, not quite a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq off 20 points, nearly 1%. The S&P 500 down 4 points, about a third of 1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for A, the latest in business and economic news, but also B, Scott's story about Chinese kids. Coming up next time on this program, also Chinese kids and how they try to get ahead, but one by one.
Anything that helps a kid become smarter and able to compete in an increasingly dog-eat-dog landscape is a priority for the parents.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.